It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Welcome to this episode of Kennedy Saves the World. And today, I'm going to save you from a problem that you might not have thought about, something you take for granted every time you travel. And that's someone who might steal your luggage as it is going around the airport carousel. Before you've made it to baggage claim, some crafty thieves may have gotten there and planted themselves before you. And when they see your beautiful glistening Tumi bag, they may make off with it before you realize it's even gone. Airport grifters on this episode of Kennedy Saves the World. And I'm joined by none other than cultural icon, film legend, bon vivant, and the proudest son of Baltimore. The one and only John Waters is with me today, and he has written a glistening novel called Liar Mouth. It is a feel-bad romance, and it has actually been bad for my health because I have been listening to the audio version on Audible on the treadmill, and I laugh so hard. It's very strange for people to see some weird lady cackling on the treadmill, but I couldn't help it with descriptions in this novel. It's also hard to believe it is John Waters' first novel, according to the literature I was given. It is so beautifully, creepily, wonderfully written. And if you are looking for a book to propel you into late spring and summer, Liar Mouth is it. John Waters, welcome to Kennedy Saves the World.
Thank you for having me. And you know, you're listening to the audiobook. Even I can't listen to my own voice for that long. But I know whenever I'm reading it, when I do the audiobook, it sounds so much worse out loud when you read it. And I look over and see the horrified expressions of the technicians that work at the place and realize, oh God. But then they laugh. They laugh.
But no, still, but that's
out loud. It's weirder, yeah.
But that's my favorite thing because oftentimes, especially someone who is well-known, they don't read their own audiobook. You know, they hire these audio performers to do it for them, but there's no way that someone could get the understanding and the nuance and the descriptions that you provide and the voice that you give to these characters. It's so incredible. So I'm listening to this book and I'm wondering, what is more satisfying for you, creating this picture in someone's head in written form, writing a novel, writing out the dialogue, crafting the story arc and all the peccadilloes that every single character has, or writing dialogue for a movie? Which is more natural for you and which do you enjoy more?
Well, I think they're the same in a way. They're very different. When you write a screenplay, you have to show it and say it. But when you write a novel, you can have 50 different thoughts about why someone is doing something. So you are working within a different genre, but it's the same thing. I want it to sound like I'm just telling you a story. So in a movie, I like three acts, a beginning, a middle, and end. In a book, I don't think there's anything, there's no such thing as a good long joke. So I don't want a comedy to be real long, but I also want it to be almost ridiculously a page turner. So many things happen in this book in 4 days that the reader almost has a heart attack from reading it, much less the character.
And it's so I'm wondering the sharp turns that these characters take. You know, my first question is, do you surprise yourself as you're writing? Or are you creating the story as you go along? Or is it something that you've already outlined and then you're just filling in the color with the descriptions and the dialogue and the inner monologues and everything else?
Well, it's some of all of it. First of all, before I even get the deal, it's like a movie. I pitch it to get my book deal, right? I've had the same publishing company, Forrest, Strauss & Giroux. I have the same editor, Jonathan Galassi. And so I tell them the story. But before I get there, before I can pitch a book, it takes me 6 months at least to think it up enough to have a treatment, to tell him this is what happened. And I tell the story over the phone. You have to be pretty far along to do that. Then once you start actually writing it, you follow that outline that you thought up, but then many, many things change. And the hardest thing is just keep going, write the first draft. But then you read it and you think, oh, this is, who wrote this? And then you keep rewriting. And every time you rewrite, you make it sound more natural, but you think up new plot points. You think up some major plot points on mine didn't come for the fourth or fifth draft of the draft of it. So you surprise yourself. That my goal is to make myself laugh first. If I can laugh first, then my friends would laugh second, and then my fans third, and then fourth, all readers that maybe never heard of one thing I've ever done.
So I was curious, especially things like a tickle subculture, and a couple things struck me as I'm reading and listening to the book, because I'm doing both at the same time. One is that, you know, the recognition that grifters have of each other. When a grifter sees another grifter in the middle of a grift, they automatically recognize what's going on. And, you know, the point of being a good grifter is you figure out how to thieve imperceptibly. And, you know, it's very subtle cues that other grifters pick up on. So that was really interesting. But the other thing that, like, the, you know, and you have always done an amazing job of shining a light on subcultures and making people laugh at them, but not shaming them. So is this
something? Making them laugh with them, yes. With them, not at them. That's a big difference. And it's all about tone.
It's also very important because, yeah. And I'm wondering, like, where do you get information about, like, tickle fetishists? And, you know, it's such a funny description of, you know, this Silverado pickup truck, and it has he, written in paint on the door. And so the reader's like, well, what does that mean? And then you find out what it means, and it's so hysterical. And I'm sitting there thinking, do people find you? Do they come up to you and tell you about their subcultures? And do you just fall in love with the ideas?
Sometimes they do, but I saw this incredible documentary about the tickle subculture and about this porn world person that owned all these tickle websites where he tricked straight guys into tickling each other in their underpants. And they were so naive, they didn't think that it was supposed to be erotic or porn. And then they became tickle stars in the gay community and were mortified and tried to get them taken down and never could. So to me, it seems so bizarre to me that you could be a tickle top or a tickle bottom.
That was the other thing that made me laugh. Like, a tickle top. I want to name my production company Tickle Top Productions, but then, you know, a few people will get the wrong idea.
And then it also said in it that I go further, but even when he was busted because he followed a cute garbage man in the window, and he said all I wanted to do was make him laugh, but the victims didn't feel that way. And they said even the judge admitted there was no rehab for tickle offenders in Baltimore. So I try to take a ridiculous subculture all through the thing. Do I actually know anyone that has the tickle fetish? Not that they've told me. I know, but there, I believe it, that there is. It's a kind of S&M. Like if you want to get tickled, then you're the S, and if you're getting tickled, the M. Even when you tickle children, it is kind of cruel. I mean, you can do it too much. So now if you see somebody tickling your child, I'd be nervous.
The other thing that I really like is, you know, in the middle of a scenario, you get everyone's thoughts of each other almost simultaneously. And, you know, that doesn't happen very often, where someone will be looking at this person, looking down on them. You know, Marcia Sprinkle, who is the protagonist, I guess, of Liar Mouth. You know, she's always looking down on everybody, and she describes herself in a certain way. She describes her figure and her hair, but then other people have a vastly different view of her. Is that something that you like doing in novel form that you maybe can't do in a film?
Well, I liked spending time with Marcia in the book. I liked being her, because each character, when I write it, I am them. Would I have liked Marcia in real life? Maybe not. But I'm not in real life. I'm in the world that I'm creating, where in all my movies and on this book, who would be a villain in most people's movie or books is the hero in my books always. And you end up weirdly rooting for someone that does such terrible things.
So I was going to say that, like, you know, hear people as you're describing them. You're like, oh, well, you know, they're stealing mail out of people's mailboxes and, you know, stealing their identities and getting, teaser rate credit cards for 30 days before they got busted in funding their lifestyle of basically being, you know, these high end squatters. You're like, I should hate everything about them. But then when they get into a pickle, you're like, oh, no, I hope Marcia makes it.
Well, that's a thing that's really true. Shred your junk mail, because people go through and steal it. And then they, you know, those little, what I hate, I think the March of Dimes does it, or some of them do. I get a couple of them that do it, where they send you stickers with your name on it already. Don't shred them. People steal them. And that's how you begin to build false identity, by having those stickers on an envelope. And then you get magazines, and you only have to get a credit card for a month. It takes 30 days before they catch you and you've charged everything. And Marcia, her partner, who is really her slave.
The loner boner, which was a great description.
The loner boner, yeah. He basically works for her, and his salary is he can have sex with her once a year. But
one day a year.
The day begins on that day, and as she says, she's no man's used up character. She's no man's used up calendar. He's not getting paid.
Yeah, no, she's figured out a way. She despises male genitalia. All right, we got more of this interview after this.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Where did you get the whole thing about crackers? Like a woman who survives on crackers because it makes for ideal eliminations.
Yeah, because she finds elimination distasteful, which I do too, actually. I think instinct, I didn't get to think it up. Why do I have to do it? And that's what Marcia does. So she just eats crackers so she can shoot out little pellets that require no cleanup.
Oh, it's so great. The book is called Liar Mouth, and I'm so glad I got through as much of it as I have. I cannot wait to...
Oh, it gets worse.
Oh, I can't wait, because as soon as I think I'm anticipating a turn or a thought or a motivation, something else happens completely, but I am transfixed. You know, just the idea of these airport baggage thieves, that's got to be a real thing.
Well, first of all, accidentally... Haven't you almost picked up the wrong bag?
Yes.
And you just say that's why you really should always put markings on it that make it stick out, because you can't get away with that excuse if you do that. But if you don't have any markings on your bag, it's easy, because I've been with people who actually did pick up the wrong bag, and we got halfway up the escalator. I know someone else that took one home, and they called the airport later when they found out, and the other person had done the same thing, and they both brought it back. But it's an easy way. I don't understand. They made security in the airport so tight after 9/11. And then suddenly, don't you remember when every airport they used to, when you got your luggage, somebody was standing there and they checked the tag? They don't do that anywhere.
Yes, they would check the baggage tag that they gave you when you checked your bag against the one affixed to the suitcase, or at least check your ID or your boarding pass. But you're absolutely right. They don't do that anymore. And, you know, that's how Marcia and Daryl were funding their lavish lifestyle, that, you know, even though they were living in McMansions, Marcia was still looking down her nose at some of these things. So when
she was squatting in foreclosed McMansions, and she took everything out because she doesn't like music because it competes with her. She doesn't like art because it's not about her. She doesn't even smell. She says her body smells like nothing. She just wants to be in control and spread anarchy through lying. And every time she lies, she feels more powerful and prettier.
Yes. And what did you say about lying is like exercise? You have to do it every day?
She tells practice lies. She tells practice lies. It's like going to the gym. She'll just tell a lie for no reason. Like if she's in line in an airport, she says, did you hear it's snowing and where they're going in the city? Probably this flight gets canceled, which calls me, why? That's like getting on their phone. She just likes that anarchy that she calls. She would take a bag. Sometimes when she didn't steal a bag, she would just take bags and put them on a different carousel just to cause trouble.
Oh, it's so good. And I rewatched Hairspray in anticipation of talking with you, because it's such a cultural phenomenon. And obviously, you know, it had a milder tone than some of your past work. But I prefer the original Hairspray. I prefer the 1988 version. Me too. Ricky Lake.
But I like the other one. And, you know, it's hard to screw up with those characters because it was a good idea. A fat girl fights for integration. You know, it was because before big girls, we never said the word fat even before it was politically incorrect. We advertised an ample girl who's proud of it.
And pleasantly plump.
I didn't want pleasantly plump. I wanted fat. Pleasantly pump. It wasn't about that. That's why I was against anyone they cast people and put fat suits on them. That's, to me, a fat suit is blackface for fat people. It makes them angry, which I get. There's a million fat girls in America that can sing. Give them the lead for once. It's the lead part.
Yeah, and who can dance.
And she gets the guy.
Which I absolutely love, but I'm watching this and Edna and the things that come out of Edna's mouth. Was there someone in your life who was Edna Turnblad?
No, there was a show called The Buddy Dean Show in Baltimore that only came on in Baltimore. We never got American Bandstand. We never got Dick Clark. And it was so popular, at the height of its success, it was on for 4 hours every day. And the local kids that were on there had the highest hairdos, the tightest pants, and they were really extreme. And I did base it on my memory from that. And I wrote an article about it in one of my books called Crackpot, where I met them. I went to their reunion. I actually had lunch yesterday with a girl that was famous on the show. They're in their 80s now. Aww. And they still go to reunions and do the dances, do the waddle and the watusi without irony. It's really beautiful. So I found it based on that. And Edna was just based on a blue collar mom in Baltimore. And I think it was, and the first time I saw Divine in the costume on the set, I didn't recognize him because Divine always played monstrous characters that we thought up to scare hippies, really. And so Divine was played the exact opposite of the image he had done. He had done that a little before in Polyester where he played an alcoholic housewife. But in this one, he played an overweight mom that took in ironing to make money and didn't quite understand her daughter trying to be famous on television. But then she supported her when she fought for integration and everything. And in real life, what happened, the show went off the air because they didn't integrate, but it wasn't the black kids and the whites sneaking on and integrating the show. The white kids snuck on Black Day when they didn't expect it. And that's what they didn't know how to handle. And they just quit the show.
It's incredible. I mean, I watched that and there are so many parallels to Blazing Saddles. You know, it's like there's so many cultural rules that were violated that are so delicious to watch. And it holds up so well. But it made me realize everyone wishes they were alive at that time. You know, and I know that you were a teenager essentially during the time in Baltimore when that was set. But
it was a terrible time in a way. You know, people talk about the 50s always was this great time. It was a horrible time. You know, I mean, it's when I grew up, but everybody had to be alike. Nothing was integrated. It was, you know, but that's why the 60s happened, really, kind of to get over that. And then the 60s got crazy, too. So I've been through every kind of extreme. I mean, I'm probably the only person that when I was young, it was actually not out of the realm of senses to have sex with somebody different every single night. And now you need 5 lawyers to ask somebody for a date. So I have lived with all extremes, and I'm glad I have, because that first extreme will never happen again. And while anyone that's listening to this show is alive, I don't believe.
Yes, and there isn't as much a push for personal freedom now. So I'm curious, you know, you wrote a beautiful commencement speech at RISD, which was published as a book, and it's one of the great pieces of advice that anyone can give to a recent grad. But what advice would you give to people in high school or college right now who have gone through the pandemic, who have had much of their freedom taken?
I'm doing a new commitment speech at Radio City Music Hall for a School of Visual Arts very soon. I would tell them they're the COVID commandos, right? Just think, you know, if the end of the world had happened, they wouldn't have missed anything. And I always say, this might be the last time you ever go out. So have a good time. I think that basically they got ripped off. You know, all young people did. They couldn't be wild. They couldn't go out and have fun. So they are the COVID commandos, the people that, and this year when I'm doing the commencement speech at School of Visual Arts, it's for the makeup one when I did it virtually 2 years ago. So they're now coming back and redoing it like real life is happening again, which I think is going to be exciting.
That's amazing.
I never thought I'd be telling young people what to do in Radio City Music Hall. Are you kidding? That's where you saw Disney films.
But it's great. Your perspective and your embrace of things that are weird and showing how beautiful they really are. It's such a great service to culture. And
kids come up to me now and say, thank you so much. You know, you made me feel like good about myself. I could get through things. I was just trying to make people laugh. And at the same time, come with me into a world maybe you might not be comfortable in, but just don't judge people. Just see something happens to people, you know? And I think all my work has been about that.
Yes.
And so I don't think, and I've just been on this book tour for Liarmouth. And what's amazing to me, this is the youngest audience I've ever had. They get younger and younger, which is really flattering to me because that is one thing you cannot buy.
No, but the fact that you continue to be motivated, inspired, that you have an endless well of characters and dialogue and humor. Very, very few people are blessed with that. So what is the secret to that?
Well, I'm nosy. I'm interested. I spy on people. I never understand people saying, I'm bored, bored. You only get one life. It's a tiny second in the history of time. You better have to be bored or you're wasting your one molecule moment. Go out there and do every possible thing while you can. Meet every person. Unfathomable human behavior interests me. I just want to see how people think. I see a lot of people think, oh, thank God I'm not that person. But I do want to know how that person thinks.
And how they feel. And you show that beautifully. John Waters, thank you so much for being part of the podcast. You are amazing. And thank you for so much entertainment and just laughter throughout the years and just being a spy on every generation. And, you know, it's like bringing about the universality of.
Right. Well, thank you so much for having me on. All right.
You're the best. Thanks, man. This has been Kennedy Saves the World. I'm Kennedy. For more podcasts from my friends at Fox, you can go to foxnewspodcast.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Oh, go ahead and leave me a review while you're there. I'd love to hear what you have to say. You've been listening to Kennedy Saves the World on the Fox News Podcast Network.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by founder and executive director of Power the Future, Daniel Turner, for a look at how we can advocate for a cleaner earth while strengthening U.S. energy independence. Available now on foxnewspodcast.com.